I want to continue this morning our discussion of church polity. That is, the idea of how local congregations are organized and function cohesively together as a unit in accomplishing the work that God has entrusted to the local congregation. Now, I'll be honest with you guys, I've struggled with this topic as far as where to begin and how to proceed with our discussion. Because I want things to be presented in a clear and logical and an orderly fashion, because I want to try to avoid confusion and misunderstanding. But this is a vast topic, and it's one that it just can't be covered in even a really long sermon, okay? And so I've struggled with how to approach it, and I've determined that we're going to have to approach this much like we might approach building a puzzle. How many of you like building puzzles? I know I get a smirk from my father-in-law over there. It's one of his pastimes. And he and I, we enjoy building puzzles together, especially around the holidays, when we're just kind of killing time and waiting around either for the next meal or the next activity. Sometimes we'll even incorporate the puzzle building into our meal eating. I don't know if you can call those meals. We're just continually grazing on stuff. But at any rate, we like building puzzles. But there's always this, where do you begin when you build a puzzle? Do you sort all of the pieces out first? And you get all of your edge pieces in a pile, and you get all of your, you know, different colors and things like that in their respective bins. Or you just dive right in and start trying to fit pieces together, you know? Well, growing up, for me, first thing, got to find the four corner pieces, you know? Then you get all your flat pieces, that's what I call them, your edge pieces, you might refer to them. You build the border first. And then you try to look at the picture and see what of the picture has the most clearly defined lines. What's going to be the easiest part to put together? And that's where you sort through and find those pieces, and you try to put together that part of it. And you save always for last the most difficult thing, like the clear blue sky, right? That's not always the way we approach building a puzzle, though, is it? Sometimes we like to make it a little bit more challenging. And so we try to do the most difficult part first. Or we start from the inside and build out to the border, right? Because we like to challenge ourselves sometimes. When we're doing that. The other question when you're building a puzzle to consider is, how dedicated are you to seeing it through? I had a puzzle when I lived in Slovakia when I was growing up of a beautiful ship with sails on it in a clear blue sky. And it was my first 1,000-piece puzzle. And I spent probably all summer working on that puzzle. And it took me just about all summer to complete it. And wouldn't you know, you get down to the last little bit of the blue sky, and that's the piece you're missing. That's frustrating. Sometimes, though, when we sit down at the holidays to build a puzzle, we almost don't get up from the card table until we're done building it. Sometimes a puzzle is something that you can't just sit down and finish in one setting. Sometimes you just kind of pick at it a little bit here and there as you have some spare time, right? And sometimes, when that's the case, it takes quite a while for that picture, that is the puzzle, to take shape, to come together. It might sit there for a while and just have a bunch of empty spots in it or something like that. But when it does finally come together, it's satisfying, especially when you've got all of the pieces. Popping in that last piece is usually the most satisfying part. We sometimes argue over who gets to do that. Well, that's a lot the way we're going to have to approach this particular topic of how the church is organized and how it's supposed to function from a biblical perspective. We've got so much material that has to be covered to be able to get the complete picture that we're going to have to do it a little at a time, piece by piece, and instead of trying to cram it all into one lesson or even just a short series of lessons. So this will be something that we'll continue to explore throughout this year periodically as we share pieces of the puzzle to make this completed picture. And so today I want to give us another piece to fit into this puzzle of church polity, church organization and function, which will hopefully build off some of the prior principles that we've already discussed. And I understand that I have a picture in my mind of what this is supposed to look like. At least I think I do. You don't have that picture in the back of your mind yet. And so as I start to lay out some pieces of this puzzle, you may not even realize that these are pieces of that puzzle. You may not see exactly how it fits in to the overall discussion or picture. But I'm hoping that over time, as we continue to lay out these pieces, once we get enough pieces on the table, you'll begin to start to see how all of these pieces fit together and make this picture of how the church is supposed to function according to the New Testament pattern. So let me begin by reminding us of a couple of pieces that we've already discussed that you may not have even realized were pieces to this puzzle. The first has to do with the idea of congregational responsibility. We've discussed previously how the whole congregation is charged with the mission of the church, that the whole group is responsible for carrying out the work of the church. It's not something that the men do alone. It's not something that just a handful of people within the church, the leaders or the elders or the pastors or the preacher or something like that. It's not something that they alone are charged with accomplishing. The whole group is responsible to carry out the work of the church. Another piece that we've talked about is the biblical principle of servant leadership. That is that God's design is that leadership within his kingdom under the New Testament dispensation, it doesn't come from those who have exalted themselves to a position over others, but rather the model is that of humble, self-sacrificial service. Right? Jesus taught the principle, the greatest of you shall become the slave of all. That's how you become great in the kingdom of God, is by stooping to serve those around you. And so that's God's design. That leadership is provided not through barking out orders and making demands and lording it over people, but by humbly leading in a godly direction. Now, if the whole congregation is to make decisions and to carry out the work of the church in submission to Jesus Christ, who is the head of the body, he is the husband of the bride, he is the Lord over the church, the question is, how exactly does that happen? How do all of the members of a local congregation work cohesively together towards a common goal? How are decisions made? How are plans formulated so that those plans can then be implemented and put into practice? Well, logically, there has to be some communication with one another in order to achieve those kinds of purposes. Right? Amos chapter 3 and verse 3. How can two men walk together unless they have an agreement or an appointment? Some of the older translations talk about the idea of having a conversation. How do we know if we're going to be working? How can you practically work together with others without talking to them, communicating with them, making sure we're all on the same page? So that we know what the goal is. What's the intent? What work are we trying to accomplish? How are we going to do that? And then let's put it into action. You have to talk with one another. Well, in what context does that type of discussion take place on the congregational level? Well, let me suggest to you that that is supposed to occur within the context of the congregational meeting, which is another point that we have previously advocated for in some of our discussion and study together. Okay, so the whole church, the whole congregation is responsible for carrying out the work of the church, and the planning, the discussion, and the working out of the how to do that is accomplished within the context of congregational meetings, the next question that we need to ask, or maybe the question that still remains, is who provides the leadership or the direction or the oversight of that effort? Well, the New Testament is clear that God's purpose and design for local congregations, His desire is that there be elders within every local church who would provide that type of service. They would be the servant leaders who provide the direction and the oversight of the work of the church. After all, the work of elders is to oversee, to watch over, to provide direction, to provide guidance, to provide leadership for the local congregation. We could look at many texts in the New Testament that illustrate that point, but that's another lesson in and of itself. The elders of a congregation are charged with watching out for the souls of the group. And as such, there is a sense in which they rule over the group, Hebrews 13 and verse 17, while at the same time not lording it over the group. Now, maybe that's another discussion we'll need to have at some other time. How can you rule over and at the same time not lord it over somebody? And yet clearly in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 3, an elder is prohibited from lording it over the flock. The picture that I see when I look into the New Testament as far as what elders are doing and how they do it, what's going on there is that there are within these congregations men who have, because of their clear and consistent demonstration of spiritual maturity, having first proven their leadership within the context of their own homes, and then demonstrated godly character among those who are outside of their homes, they've earned the trust of their brethren. And because the brethren within that congregation trust them, the group formally asks these men to lead them. And at the same time, the congregation is formally submitting themselves voluntarily to the proven servant leadership that those men will provide. That's what God desires within every local church. That's His design. That's His plan. Okay, well, that's all well and good, but we don't have elders. So, what do we do if we don't have elders? Let me first observe that we know that churches can and have existed for a time without elders. So the fact that we don't have elders doesn't need to send us into an out-and-out panic. Oh, no, we're not organized. Oh, we're not doing things right. Okay? When you look at the Acts narrative of the establishment of local churches throughout the Mediterranean world, it's clear that churches existed for a period of time before they grew to a point where they had a plurality of men who could serve as elders. And so we know that part of God's plan, as churches are planted and as they grow, there's going to be a period of time where they function without elders. But the goal is that we are to pursue having elders within every church, because that's the ideal situation. Now, unfortunately, there is no clear or explicit biblical instruction on how a local church is to be organized or function in the absence of elders. Now, I would suggest to you that it's that way for possibly a few reasons. Perhaps God left it vague in His instruction because His intent is for us to press on and grow to the point where we do have elders, right? He didn't want to give us a second option with which we could then become comfortable in an incomplete or lacking state. All right? There is a sense in which, guys, there are some things that are lacking within our congregation here because we don't have elders. There are some things that are out of order that need to be set in order, which can only be done by appointing elders. And so I think God didn't give us an alternate plan because he doesn't have any intention of us pursuing an alternate format. He wants us to strive towards the place and time when we'll have elders. He doesn't want us to substitute another model for his plan and his purpose for the church, thinking that, well, he said this is the pattern, so it's just as good as having elders. He didn't want us to develop that attitude. But additionally, I think he's vague enough and general enough in his instructions because he, in his infinite wisdom, knew that every single congregation was going to be unique. And that every congregation was going to be at different places and different levels of different points down the road towards having elders. You might have some that are just brand new congregations with only a few people. And all those people are brand new converts right out of the world, right? Well, that congregation is farther away from having elders than, let's say, a congregation that's existed for 20 or 30 years and has multiple generations of Christians who are part of that congregation. And so God recognized that we're all going to be at different places along this journey towards having elders, and that each congregation is going to be unique. And so he wanted to leave us as much latitude as possible in working out how exactly we're going to function until such a time as we have elders. And so we need to acknowledge that since there is no exact or singular way, at least from my understanding at this point from the biblical teaching, on how exactly to do this, it means we're going to have to exercise some judgment in this area on how we as a congregation choose to proceed. But as we do that, let me suggest to you that there is a twofold question that we need to consider when we choose which route are we going to pursue. First off, whichever route we choose, it must first and foremost be authorized. That is, it has to be in keeping with clear biblical principles. And secondly, and maybe this is more of a logical reason than a biblical reason, but wouldn't it make sense that if we could find multiple ways that are authorized in Scripture, that we would choose the option that moves us towards having shepherds or elders the most naturally, quickly, and effectively? I think that should factor into which route we choose to take. So, what are some of the ways that we could do this? What are some of the ways that we as a local congregation could function to carry out the business of the church, knowing that right now we do not have elders to guide or lead or oversee the congregational meeting? Let me begin this morning to share with you three options for how a church might function in the absence of elders. And I will tell you up front that these three options are not original to me. I didn't develop them. I didn't coin the phrases. I didn't come up with the idea. In fact, I believe I first heard them by listening to some audio sermons of a guy by the name of Tommy Hamilton, who preaches down in a church in Florida, I think in the Tampa area. And they have been shared with me multiple times since I originally heard them, always attributed to Tom Hamilton. So I'll give him credit for these three options. But I'm going to not share them in exactly the same order that he typically shares them, at least when I've heard him talk about these things. But when we look at each of these three options, I want us to evaluate the option and look at, first of all, what would it look like in practice? Okay? And then let's try to identify maybe some of the benefits and also some of the shortcomings or some of the problems that go along with that type of a model. But also, I want us to ask with each one, is this method, is this model of how the church functions, is it consistent with the two principles that we have previously outlined in our discussion on church polity, namely the congregational responsibility and the principle of servant leadership? So that's what I'd like to try to accomplish with you today and next week by looking at some of these things. So the first option that we could pursue, option number one, minority-led congregations. Well, what does that look like? What do I mean by that? In this model, the church operates on the assumption that any action must gain universal, unanimous consent from the whole group, from every single member of the congregation, before anything can be implemented. And so, even if a single member of the local church disagrees, even if only one person says, nope, I don't want to do that, all progress is immediately halted and no action is taken. Because you have to have unanimous agreement in order to do anything. The reason why we call this minority-led is because of really some of the problems with this approach. Essentially, under this approach, the leadership consists of one or at best a few within the group who are trying to be the greatest, who are trying to put their way ahead of everybody else. They have this, it's my way or the highway kind of attitude. Either you do what I want you to do, or we're not doing anything. And so by exercising the heckler's veto, the minority handicaps the ability of the congregation to make any progress. They arrest any potentiality for development or work to be done, unless it's something they want to see happen. Because they know if unanimity is required to proceed, and I don't want to proceed, all I got to do is say nay. And then nothing can happen. The direction and the progress of the group in this model are limited by the desires, oftentimes, of the least mature, the weakest, and often the most carnally minded members among us. It's a very selfish attitude to have, to say, unless you do what I want to do, I'm not going along with it. That's carnal. That's fleshly. That's not a characteristic of someone who's striving towards spiritual maturity to be like Christ. But something that we need to understand, and this is, in my opinion, the greatest problem with this option, is that when we begin to look at the biblical record and the pattern and the example that's laid out for us, it becomes very clear that unanimity is not required for a group to take action. So, for example, in the book of Ezra, Ezra chapter 10, we have a situation where the exiles who have returned from Babylonian captivity and rebuilt the temple and are living in and around Jerusalem, that some of them have taken foreign wives. They've intermarried with the people of the land. And when this comes to the attention of Ezra the priest, he is distraught about this. Because one of the basic principles that God had taught his people Israel when he called them out of Egyptian bondage and made them his nation, he said, don't intermarry with the people of the land because it will always lead to trouble. They will draw your hearts away from me and you'll begin to pursue idols. And yet that's exactly what these people have done. And so Ezra is distraught about this. He prays about it. He's in a heap crying about it in the public square. And in chapter 10, several people gather around him. I love Shechaniah here in verse 2. We need more Shechaniahs among us. Because Shechaniah essentially says to Ezra, he says, Ezra, listen, man, you're the leader. You're the priest. You need to show us what to do. Lead us in the right direction, and I'll be right there with you. You take the lead, and I've got your back, man. That's essentially what he says. And so they decide to call an assembly of all the people. We read in verse 7, they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the exiles that they should assemble at Jerusalem. And whoever would not come within 3 days, according to the counsel of the leaders and the elders, all his possessions should be forfeited, and he himself excluded from the assembly of the exiles. And so all the men of Judah, Benjamin, assembled at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the 9th month, on the 20th of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. And Ezra the priest stood up and he said to them, "You have been unfaithful and have married foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore make confession to the Lord God of your fathers and do his will and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." Then all the assembly replied with a loud voice, "That's right. As you have said, so it's our duty to do. But there are many people, it's a rainy season, and we're not able to stand here in the open, nor can the task be done in 1 or 2 days, for we have transgressed greatly in this matter. Let our leaders represent the whole assembly, and let all those in our cities who've married foreign wives come at appointed times, together with the elders and the judges of each city, until the fierce anger of our God on account of this matter has turned away from us." So Ezra indicts them of their sin. They acknowledge, we've sinned, we've got to rectify this. But this is a big problem. It's too big to be worked out all in one day. So let's make some appointments. And over the coming days, these people can come at the appointed times and sit down with the leaders, and you'll get it all. We'll make sure everybody's doing the right thing. Okay? That's the plan. That's the proposition.
How this assembly is going to get back in the good graces of God, back in line and in keeping with his will and his teaching. But notice verse 15. Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Josiah, the son of Tikva, opposed this, with Meshulam and Shabbatai, the Levite, supporting them. Of all the congregation, everybody's in agreement with this plan except for 4 guys. They're opposing it. They don't want to do it. Now, if minority-led is the right principle, their veto should have stopped anything from happening. We didn't have unanimous agreement. But notice the beginning of verse 16. But the exiles did so. They knew it was the right thing to do. And so, despite the fact that there was 4 men among them who said, "Nope, we don't want to do it. We don't want to go along with it." They said, "Too bad. We're doing the right thing anyway." In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, Paul, talking about the brother who was disciplined, that he had written to them in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and said, "You need to withdraw your fellowship from this guy. You need to not associate with him any longer because he's living in open sin." You might wonder, did the Corinthians follow that instruction? Did they do what Paul told them to do? Well, he seems to allude to this in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And in verse 6, he says, "Sufficient for such a one is the punishment which was inflicted," notice this, "by the majority. So that on the contrary, you should rather forgive and comfort him. Otherwise, such a one might be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow." It would appear to me that at worst, perhaps not everyone in Corinth went along with the teaching that Paul gave them in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Not everyone was faithful in following through on the discipline that Paul said needed to be administered against this brother. But the majority went ahead and did it anyway. And guess what? It worked. Sufficient for such a one was the discipline that was inflicted by the majority here. So we have some Old Testament example of how unanimity is not required to take the right action. We also have a New Testament example or precedent that not everybody has to agree on a course of action in order for the group to do the right thing, to do the thing that God has required. And so when we compare then this model to our two principles, What's striking to me is that the attitude of the minority in this model is clearly inconsistent with the principle of servant leadership, in that the needs of others, that is, what is truly best for the whole group, is made subordinate to that one's own selfish desire and will. And additionally, this approach undermines the responsibility of the whole congregation to carry out the work of the church. In fact, this model undermines the authority of the group, period, because it takes the authority away from the whole group and puts it in the hands of a cantankerous curmudgeon most oftentimes. You're going to do it the way I want to do it, or we ain't doing nothing at all. And that, my friends, is a relationship and a model that is not built on mutual trust, but rather a dictatorship that is built on stubborn obstinance. It's not in keeping with the biblical teaching. Next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll come back and look at option 2 and option 3 and weigh them against what the Bible teaches, as well as our two principles, and see which one is the best option to take.